Welcome to Live at the Backyard Comedy Club podcast. Welcome back, if you have come back. Welcome new people, thanks.
If they haven't come back, then they can't hear this.
Oh, they'll hear it.
We'll send it to them.
Yes.
We'll wax stamp it.
What's that a euphemism for?
I don't know, David. You told me about the position, and now I've just been saying it. I did get slapped twice for it, though, so I don't know.
The position?
Doesn't matter. We'll talk about it later. And back.
On this week's show, we are interviewing the wonderful and very funny Chris Betts. He is a very funny man. I've geeked with him many, many times, and we have a lovely conversation about comedy and the like. You'll have a lovely game of Guess Who when we're talking about various different actors and comedians that we feel some need not to mention their actual name. Answers on a postcard and send it to Blue Peter. Maybe.
They will send you a prize, probably.
Yeah, they'll send you a badge or a restraining order, maybe an ankle bracelet. please, we haven't asked you this for a while because, you know, we feel a bit patronising to do so, but please rate and review us on iTunes. Tweet about it. We do have the Twitter account. We don't use it very often, but if you said something nice, we'd definitely retweet you. It is at BYC Podcast. That's Backyard Comedy Podcast, obviously. Have you got anything to say about this week's episode?
I had a great time.
Good stuff. Always a lovely moment from Chris Anastasi. Enjoy the show with Chris Betts. Release the terabytes. I mean, it's not untrue, but...
Wait, what? Where's this going? We were having a laugh, David.
We got real serious real quick.
We've awoken something.
Yeah. Oh, no. Someone didn't perfect his views on the way over.
Well, like I've always said to David, he's like a man that was lost over the Bermuda Triangle in the 20s and has just arrived back in his biplane.
That makes sense. Yeah, you're like Brendan Fraser in Blast from the Past.
Lord Flashheart.
Now, where did I park that biplane? So, Chris, welcome to the Backyard Comedy Club podcast. You
Thanks
played this
me.
Room many, many times.
Yeah, man, love it.
First thing I'm aware of you is, I think, was it Edinburgh 2015? You had a show at the Pleasance?
2015, that was probably, Social Animal.
Yeah, you had a big post of you being behind a bar, like looking like a landlord.
Yeah.
And I was aware of that show before I'd seen you on the circuit. Did you come over from Canada immediately to do that show? Or?
No, embarrassingly, I'd been over for 3 years.
Oh, right. Well,
yeah,
right.
So I was in the Pleasance Reserve the year before.
Ah, right, I see.
And the year before that, I went up with two friends, and none of us had done the Fringe before. Mm. And we did a show called We're New Here. And they fell out. Both of them, I think, have since quit doing stand-up.
Nice.
They fell out a week into the Fringe and stopped talking to each other.
Amazing.
And so, yeah, it was a dream.
where did you do that show?
In the staff room, which I think is a new name now, at Three Sisters, which is a terrifying room. There were bloodstains on the wall and an unidentified brown stain that we assumed was shit but couldn't prove was shit. And so the first 10 minutes of every show, it was a tiny little box you could fit 20 people in it max, and the first 10 minutes was always calming people down about where they were.
Really?
It was like, we know it's scary, we know we're 6 inches away from you, and this is very intense, but we're nice guys. it was quite a time. It was quite a time.
How did you find, you know, was that, you'd been in England for 3 years and that was your first Fringe, how did you find?
And then you'd only just go with that?
That was, I'd been over for about 10 months when that happened.
Three years at the point of the show. I referenced.
Yeah.
Right, so that was 10 months and then you were straight to the Fringe.
Yeah.
How did you find going to Edinburgh Fringe? Because it's quite a lot for people that have been before.
I had a great time. I think partly because the guys on my show had such an awful time.
Right.
That, like, comparatively, I was having a blast. And so I met a girl that I liked. I got to meet a bunch of really cool comics. I saw a bunch of shows from... Like, that's the nicest thing, is you're never more than 10 feet away from a really good show.
Hmm.
And so I love that. I went and saw more shows that year than I've seen since, combined.
Right.
And so it was really exciting for me. It was really cool because we don't have that in Canada. We have fringe festivals, but nothing on that scale.
Yeah.
And no, like, the bullshit shows at the Fringe are so funny to me that we don't do that in Canada either. Like, people that, there's a level of theatricality in British entertainment that just is not allowed for in Canada. I think because we're just bullies at heart. And so like, we just won't allow it. So a lot of these acts would have just been bullied out of existence long before they made it to the Fringe. So, like, I remember last year I was flyered by a Harry Potter a cappella group. And I was like, no, you never would have made it to stage. This couldn't have happened.
How does this bullying happen in Canada?
Overtly. Really overtly.
Because you do have a reputation for being nice.
Yeah, but, like, we're dicks. It's just because no one lives there. We're the world's biggest small town.
Right.
And so, like, we have Toronto, which is technically a city. And I always thought that it was a big city. And then I lived in London for a few years. And I was like, this is fucking quaint. And Toronto's very sweet and everyone is pretty nice. But there is, like, a real... Like, I think of the story. Do you know Dylan Gott?
Yes.
Canadian comedian?
Mm.
So funny. So Dylan was over here for a while. And he pointed something out that I'd never realized before. He said, Canadian comedians never dress well. And he's like, why do you think that is? I was like, I don't know why. He's like, because Canadians are assholes and they will make fun of you for dressing well. And he told me the story about a guy who, he was gigging in the East, in, like, I think in the Maritime somewhere, Nova Scotia or something. And he was dressed up nice. He had, like, a nice shirt on. He had nice trousers. He was ready for a show. Dress shoes, Saturday night headliner. And headliner's back home to 45 minutes. Five shows, one Thursday, two Friday, two Saturday. So 5 hours a weekend. And for 45 minutes, they hate this guy. Total silence, not even like yelling anything, just total like kind of ignored silence. One guy puts his hand up in the audience and the guy goes, fine, yeah, what? What's your question? And the guy just goes, you a fag? Not with any malice. Just a genuine curiosity. Are you a fag? And he goes, I mean, no, but what? And he goes, oh, okay, cool. I just, because the way you're dressed, I just thought you were a fag. No problem. And the crowd didn't, like, they weren't surprised. They didn't laugh and be like, who the fuck is this guy? They all just went like, oh, I guess he's not a fag. Look at that. Huh. So, yeah, we're a bunch of fucking, like, we've got, like, hick in our bones.
Mm. But there's, like, a nice, a polite way of delivering it.
Yeah, there's a general, like, there's a kindness, but also a real viciousness to Canadians.
Wow.
Yeah, that's why, I mean, it's kind of hack to say, but that's why hockey is so fucking popular back home.
Right.
Because we love a fight.
Mm.
I'll never forget being 10, going to my first professional hockey game at a, what was it, the Pacific Coliseum in Vancouver. And someone hit the captain of our team, Trevor Linden. And the whole stadium started screaming, Gino, 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 thousands of people all together. And I looked at my dad, I was like, what are they doing? And he said, oh, they want Gino Ogic to beat up that man. And so it was like the Colosseum. It was Spaniard, Spaniard. And he came out, that was Gino Ogic's whole job. So he came out and he beat the hell out of people.
That's amazing.
They're called enforcers. That's his whole job.
So I recently listened to on Audible, there was a podcast that told the story of this enforcer who, you know, he wanted to be like a proper ice hockey player, but his talents did not that way lie.
Yeah.
And but he ended up getting to being in the all pro game. I must find
The
name.
All-Star game.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
And the league didn't want it to happen. They thought it was a disgrace that he'd be in it. So they in fact traded him out of the sort of top league into the American league so he couldn't qualify.
Oh, wow.
But then there was such a backlash against the fact that he had the most votes of everybody.
Yeah.
And so they had to play him. And then he scored a goal. I was almost welling up when I was listening to this podcast on the tube. He had a moment of genuine skill in the All-Star game, and yet he has not played since.
Well, that was I remember that moment, and I wish I could remember the name. My brother's like a hockey genius.
Something like Matt Smith or something.
Everything. I couldn't even tell you if I heard it. But I remember that happening because the NHL, for the first year, allowed fans to vote on who would be in the All-Star game. And fans uniformly were against this. Like, it's not a popularity contest. It's a meritocracy. The best players get in the All-Star game. Why are you asking us this? And so they purposely voted for this guy who just isn't very good.
Right.
And it was a huge campaign, and everybody got behind it. And when he got in, it was like a Bodie McBoatface.
Yeah.
It was, you just give us an opportunity, we will ruin this.
Well, it's 1 year we had our Christmas number one was System of the Down, because everyone wanted to go against the X Factor song.
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's right.
The chorus line, fuck you, I won't do what I'm told to.
Yeah.
Oh, that was Rage Against the Machine. But
Oh, sorry, it was Rage Justice.
Yeah, Killing in the Name of.
Very different.
And it was, I think people got really upset about it, partly because it was really sweet that he got in, because he seemed like an all right guy.
But also in this interview, this podcast is really good, actually. It's called, I think it's called Game Changers.
Okay.
And it's about, like, a few, that each episode is about somebody who completely changed a sport.
Okay. And he got it? That's funny.
But he changed the politics of the sport.
Okay, yeah.
You know, you know, the Williams sisters in tennis. And,
oh, yeah.
It's a really interesting. I don't know. I'm advertising a different podcast on this podcast, but
hey, man, we're all out here listening.
Yeah. That's fine.
Yeah. I wonder if they'll give us a shout.
It's plenty of hours in the, day. I'll tweet them.
It was quite moving because this guy, he didn't bring it upon himself. He wasn't behind this campaign.
No, he didn't organize it.
He just wanted to be a ice hockey player.
Yeah, man. He was just out there living his dream. And then he was the one that was picked. And then it was, I think we were infuriated because they clearly weren't taking it seriously because they asked fans to vote. And then suddenly when we voted, then they took it too seriously. We were like, pick a side. Either it's us or it's not. And I don't know how the voting's
going. Is that very Canadian? Do you think that whole story encapsulates a Canadian characteristic of...
You know, I don't know. I'm still not sure what it is to be Canadian.
Right.
Because mostly we define ourselves as not American.
Right.
And so when at your core you're a reaction to someone else, it's tough to pin down something that's authentically you.
It's quite a... I know a Canadian that whenever he's asked whether he'll go back, he says, no, it's too socialist.
Who? Well, you don't have to name him, but that's insane. All right. Whatever. Where does he live now? Here?
Yeah.
All right.
I think that conversation surmises the Canadian viciousness. So, what year did you come here then? That was 2000?
What are we now? 2018? I guess I came over in September 2012, I guess, or 2013, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
And but I've lived over here on and off for 12 years. I lived in Brighton for 4 years when I was 19 to 23, bartended down there. Came back for a girl for a couple years, which never works out. And then I came back this time to do stand-up in about 2012, 2013.
Oh, right. So you came back for the, I'm going to go do stand-up in...
Yeah, that was my purpose, was to come over here and be a professional comedian.
In London, is that where you decided to come to? Yeah. Why did you pick, why London?
I met Glenn Wool. I don't know if you know Glenn.
No, Glenn very well.
Glenn is amazing. Glenn is one of my favorite comedians. If you're listening to this and you don't know Glenn Wool, check out Glenn Wool. He's one of the best. And go see him live as well. He's magic. But I got to do a show with him in a weed room in Toronto, because those exist. And he just crushed so hard and so beautifully that I was in awe of him. And I asked him, because he'd done London and Toronto, and I came up in Montreal, which is like the Bristol of Canada.
Mm.
It's a really great place to start, really supportive, but if you stay too long... you might get a little weird, or you lose that callus because everything's so nice,
right?
That it's then tough to live anywhere else or face like London audiences. Mm. And Toronto is the London of Canada, I guess. And so that's where you go to be a pro. It's one of those two. And right. The States cost $10,000 to get into, so I didn't have that. I still don't. And so there's a. So I asked him, and he said London every time. And so I believed him because he's Glenn.
Yeah.
So I came over here specifically. To do stand-up and become a professional at it, and to gig in a place where nobody cares. Like, the audience is really... I mean, you guys know, audiences in London don't give a shit if we're alive or dead. Like, just don't care what happens to us when we're not on stage, and I like that.
It's a very royal sense that we have, which is, bring your entertainment to me, stand at my throne, and make me laugh, and go away. That's it.
Yeah.
Bring me my things from the Empire, then go away.
It's really nice. It's changing a little bit now. A lot of audiences are starting to be more interested in who you are as a person, as opposed to just the jokes. But the most part, it's still just like, you're either funny or you're not, and I love that.
Yeah.
Because then it's something to measure yourself against.
Where did you start coming into in London? How did you access the comedy scene here?
I just started doing open mics. I googled open mic comedy. I ended up at Lion's Den, which is like a perennial first London gig.
In King's Cross.
And it wasn't, I don't know if they're still going, it was in the basement of Bar Rumba. And you had to pay to get on. I did it once, and I was like, I'm never paying to get on stage again in my life.
Yeah.
And I got on. I was the 21st act. I was the last one, and it wasn't. They didn't have a lineup. They just pulled names out of a hat, and so a lot of people were there, and they paid £4, but they never got on stage.
What?
Oh yeah, yeah. It was crazy. This place was nuts. And so I went last, and I had a nice set, and it was good, and I met a bunch of comics through that, and then they recommended me to more comics.
Nice.
And so comedy is mostly nepotism. There's a lot of, like, I saw this guy, I vouch for him.
Yeah.
And they're funny, and so it worked out through that, and I just gradually built up from there.
Yeah, word of mouth is an oddly powerful thing, isn't it?
Oh, it's everything.
You know, you could be the best in the game, but if no one likes you, if there's no one who in the right place who likes you, then you're not going anywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, it's really, you're just waiting to find the right person to sort of move you along.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But that's part of the fun.
How was that first gig? Did the audience receive you well?
I had a weirdly good one.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it went well, partly because I'd already been going for a few years in Montreal, and I was just starting to work weekends in Canada, and so I had a set that I had bits that worked. Whereas a lot of people who do line stand, it's like their first ever gig, and so I came on with confidence and some jokes that were fine, and so that blew people's minds.
So I didn't have any jokes for like the first 2 years.
Mm. What were you doing?
Just
pantomime.
Just verbal diarrhea.
They were buying it.
So it was just sort of like, I just couldn't write for Toffee, so I was just sort of like hoping something would hit me in inspiration when I'd hit the stage.
Oh wow, so you'd go up and just riff for the first 2 years?
Yeah. That's, well, maybe not the 2 years, insane. First year, yeah.
That's like, crazy to me.
I realised that writing a joke might be actually doing my homework and writing an act might actually be easier than trying to... Because sometimes it would be sublime, but probably only one in about five.
There were guys like that. We didn't meet on the open mics. There were guys like that in the mics over here who blew me away. Like, they couldn't write a joke, and they were trying, and they were like funny people. But you're learning; it's a tough thing. I remember them saying, "Excuse me, I can't write a joke, but." I think I can just be funny on stage. It's like, dude, if you can't be funny when you're like purposely working on it, then there's no way that you'll be able to do this sort of thing. The confidence that it takes to do that always blew me away. I've never had that much self-belief.
Well, this is we've talked about this before on the podcast, but there's sort of like a difference between the performer who writes and the writer who performs. I don't do it anymore. But even now, you know, I don't write a whole bit. I have an idea for a bit, and then I take it on stage and kick it around.
Okay.
And then put on a bit, and then add a bit, and then cut a bit, and then that's how it grows.
Yeah.
But I at least take a idea of what I'm going to do on stage now, rather than...
That's something. That's a direction, at least.
Yes.
That being said, Russell Hicks is incredible at doing that. Russell Hicks is the only guy I know who legitimately goes on with nothing. And will storm it.
Really?
Really kicks it. I've seen him carried off stage. Really? And they hated him at first. That was the fun. We were at a university in Kent. 500 people. Great show. Russell was going last. And they couldn't have hated him more for the first 10 minutes. They really just weren't on board with this American dude who was up there yelling at them. And then, I don't know what it was, but it just clicked in. And they were like, we love you now. We love you forever. And we'll never stop. And by the end, he's like, I could probably be carried out of this room. And a bunch of kids ran up to the stage. We're like, we'll catch you. And he jumped off and they carried him around the room. Never seen anything like it.
Wow.
He's incredible.
Well, he just berates them until...
Well, no, but he's really good at pulling things out of people. Mm. And so he'll find out something interesting about you real quick. And then can just riff on it. Like, his mind's so quick. And he's gotten... so good at remembering everything and then calling back to things and tying things all together. So he'll take 10 different people's stories and turn them into one. And it's really beautiful to watch. It's so much fun.
Yeah, I'll have to go catch him live. That'll be great.
Yeah, he's great. Definitely. I remember seeing him in Edinburgh. I think the year that you saw my poster, he was doing 3 shows every day. 3 hours of just off the top of his head. And he was saying that he was in one room. I can never remember the venue for this. But it was this big room, and when no one would be in there, he was on at like noon, he would just start doing the show. And so he'd just start talking and just like start riffing on things in the room and start going, and people would hear him in the bar, and then they would come into the room, and then gradually he'd like pull them in and get them to be an audience, and his audience would sort of grow like that. It's incredible. The work ethic on this guy.
Sweet wow. Jesus.
Oh, second to none. Really, really cool. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
Well, so you said that you're not that confident to go up without material for 2 years. How did you first get on stage? Right, what made you first do it?
I wanted to do stand-up since I was 6.
Oh.
It's my whole life. It's all I ever wanted.
It's your big drive.
Yeah, I just love it. It's so much fun. And I didn't want to do it until I had a reason to be standing in front of people. Like, I feel like if you're going to announce your thoughts to a room, you better have something worth saying. And it doesn't have to be important, but it just has to be different. It has to be something new, something that other people don't think. Otherwise, what are you doing up there?
Yeah.
And so I waited for a long time. And I think I started when I was 26. And like, I traveled the world. I had a bunch of different jobs. I tried to do as much as I could. And then the only reason that I did my first gig, that I was finally kind of bullied into it, was two of my friends were marrying each other, but they're friends from different groups. And so I knew both of them.
Oh, right.
And so they asked me to MC their wedding because I could sort of dabble in both, but not many people knew both of them very well. And I couldn't ruin their wedding in good conscience. And so I decided that wouldn't be the first time I was on a microphone in front of a room. And so I signed up and I did an open mic because of them.
And that was your first gig?
That was my first gig.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you spent so many years preparing.
Yeah.
Right. And it's quite interesting, you lived that wayward life and then it's not that you found your calling, you knew what your calling is, so you went wayward to learn about the world.
Yeah.
And have experience.
What did you do in these sort of like years between leaving school and that first gig? What were you doing?
Anything.
Making a living?
Yeah, all kinds of stuff. I did, like jobs wise, I did, I was an award-winning bartender. I did demolition, construction, plumbing. I painted houses. I coached a baseball team. I worked in a refugee camp. I was briefly homeless. I worked in an HMV. What else did I do? I was a janitor for a while. That was a really good job, actually. Janitor's underrated. People really just leave you alone with your thoughts. It's kind of nice. I lived in France, Ireland, Thailand. Thailand was cool because it was a Buddhist monastery that was a refugee camp, and it was in this tiny little town that was right on the Burmese border, and so what would happen is because like everyone's talking about the Rohingya massacres right now, which are horrific, but they're not new. They've been doing that for years, and so what the Burmese army was doing, they would come into villages, kill all the adults, and then just send the kids into the woods and be like, good luck, go get them. And so some of these kids would end up in this town, and the monks would bring the kids in, and they were technically apprentice monks, but it was really sweet because the monks weren't like, oh, we're going to turn these kids Buddhist.
They were technically apprentice monks.
Well, that was it. There was no sense of
didn't
like
have their flying license.
It wasn't like we got more one. They weren't proselytizing. They were just like, we're going to raise these kids to work hard, and we're going to teach them a bunch of stuff. But you know, maybe one of them will end up being a monk. But we just want them to be ready so they can go out. And that's why we were there. My friend Christina and I were there. And we were teaching English and a little bit of computer stuff. Just because the monks were like, they need to learn these things if they want to live.
Wow.
And so get out there. But they also ran an organic farm
there. How did you end up there?
a friend of mine who was one of the people who got married to do my first gig is a human rights lawyer. And she was working at a refugee camp down the road. And one of the monks came to her and said, do you know anyone who'd be interested in coming and helping us? And she thought of me. And so I went out and did that.
That's and amazing.
It was the best.
You're like the Forrest Gump of comedy. Met the president, made him laugh.
I did meet the Prime Minister of Canada. I did. Oh, and
you're a Canadian Forrest Gump.
Yeah, and I made him laugh. Yeah, I forgot about that. Yeah, I met him. He was funny. It was the current Prime Minister's dad that I met, Pierre Trudeau. It was Justin Trudeau's dad. Yeah.
What was he like?
I didn't realize you had a monarchy.
Yeah. We've got dynasties now. We're doing the whole thing. We've got another old Prime Minister's kids, Brian Mulroney. His grandkids are in Meghan Markle's bridal group. I don't know what you call them. No. So they're all intermingling. They're all there.
Yeah. Are you doing Edinburgh this year?
Yeah, man.
Where and when?
I'm doing my show, Chris Betts versus the Audience.
Oh yes, yes. Tell us about the show. You've been doing this show about, haven't you?
Yeah. I do it regularly in London. I'm taking it out of town for the first time next week. I'm going to Bristol and doing it. I want to do a little mini tour next year because it's just so goddamn fun. And so I argue the opposite of anything anyone in the audience says.
Right. What have been the good examples of this?
My favorite one recently was I won in favor of incest.
Nice.
Yeah.
So what was your
winning gambit?
Yeah. I think it was I came out strong and then I wrong-footed them and then they didn't know quite what to do. Where I went with the if you're gonna have a late night booty call, you don't want to involve night buses and stuff. It's just easier if they're down the hall. It's a proximity game. They're right there. And you know, it's probably, you know, if we've learned anything from Game of Thrones, it's that you can only trust family. And so, you know, if you want to rise up. Because think about it, the only people that haven't really taken a hit are the brother and sister that are fucking each other. They're the only ones that are still on top of their game.
It's true.
Everyone else's lives have been upended.
Especially if you're into the weird stuff, because after any breakup, you just can trust that no one's going to say anything.
Yeah,
everyone's implicit.
Right? Omerta. Who can keep a secret like family? That's the whole point of the mafia.
Start something called the Family Commission.
So that's, I just do that for an hour.
Incest for an hour.
Incest lasted about, that was like a 10-minute one. Until they finally exhausted all their arguments, and I rebutted everyone. And it's fun because it's not about who's right; it's just about who argues best.
Oh,
so yeah. It's just a rhetorical exercise, and it's stupid and fun, and I love it.
Do you watch actual debates, like debate competitions? Because it is it's almost like a sport.
Yeah,
the way they come back and forth, it is a real skill to have.
I really want to debate the Oxford Debating Society.
That would be incredible. But on frivolous subjects.
Yeah. I want them to play my game.
That would be amazing.
Yeah. I think I could take my favorite, the biggest compliment I got, other than people coming back, which is nice, because a lot of people come back 3 or 4 times during the Fringe, because it's never the same show. It's completely different. Mm. And they come back ready to play. But now I have comedians as the judge. So I have a judge who decides who won and then picks the last topic. So I have no say over it, neither does the audience. So it's fun, it's a gambit. Mm. And but I used to pick it out of the audience, and one guy that I picked was a literal judge.
Oh my God.
And he was great, he was so much fun, he played the game perfectly. And at the end, he came up to me and he's like, if you don't drop as many F-bombs, you'd be a great barrister.
Wow.
Oh, that's all I wanted to hear.
Like Judge Judy.
Yeah.
That's amazing. Do you find it ups your spontaneity as well, like doing this over and over again, so you just make you quicker?
Yeah, completely, because I have a lot more trust now that something funny will come out.
Yeah.
I believe that I'll get there. And so I'm not in as much of a rush. And I'm not kind of panicked.
It's so much part of it, isn't it?
Just
ask another question, take another line of questioning.
Yeah. Or even take a pause. Just take a second to think about it. And don't worry. It's okay. It's okay to just be quiet for a second. Just think about it, and then go in. And they're happy. They want to watch what you're going to come out with. So
nothing. I no annoying than when comedian asks, like, what do you do for a living? And they go, IT. And you go, well, I've got nothing on that. Well, that's not their fault.
Yeah. Yeah.
Think something up.
Yeah.
Your job is to think something up. Do it now.
Yeah.
Yeah,
you do something actually when someone throws out a job where you kind of, you like, I know that you've got nothing in that moment, but you throw a look out to the audience that just lets the audience assume whatever you're thinking. Perfectly for it. You've just got this look that saves you for anything. I think that's what you need, right? If you ever have a blank, just have a look. And I see it, you do see it. It's the difference between comedians that have the confidence, or at least can fake the confidence enough to make the audience comfortable, that they're comfortable with silence. That's what you've got to be, right? It's
not too much.
Just come out, say nothing.
Yeah.
I'm sure there's been comedians who have subverted by just going up and saying nothing.
I had this horrific audience member down in not in Bright, I can't remember the name of the place, it was with S anyway. It was a big gig, and I was on first, and the compere had done about 15 minutes, and this guy just interrupted and interrupted and interrupted the compere. And I went on stage and just decided I'd ignore him. I wouldn't give him the oxygen to it. And I sort of like just got on with my act and tried to ignore him. But I didn't realise until this point. I mean, it was almost like he was scalpel precision heckling. Because what he was doing is he wasn't really heckling like a your shit or something. He'd say something, sometimes like, that's not funny. But it'd be in just the little gap that you leave between feed and punchline, where you have to have that moment of silence before then you go, you know, that's what she said, or whatever. Whatever that. You need to have that moment of hiatus, and having that moment broken every time was just... It was precision heckling. I don't understand.
That's spiteful.
Yeah. Oh, it was definitely spiteful. Yeah. It was definitely spiteful. So when I left in the interval after I'd been on, I just saw some women just like literally screaming at him, pointing in his face. So that I heard going, I've paid for a babysitter, and you're ruining this show. Yeah.
Go back to Canada.
Yeah, I will not go back. You either book me on this show, or I ruin everyone's.
Keeps putting his hand up at the wrong time.
I don't know why I got to that. Pause. The meaning of you do need a quality of silence to be able to deliver a good punchline. You need it to have space and air. That was my
point. I mean, yes, no. There's something like, if you watch old Chris Rock specials, it was just like a machine gun. It just pow, 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 pow. But then, and it didn't matter that much. He still had like pauses, but they weren't pregnant pauses. They didn't last. He didn't sit in any silence. He would just crush. But then you watch like Patrice O'Neill's Elephant in the Room.
It's great. He's
beautiful, like a flawless hour. It's so intimidating. These beautiful long pauses where you can just, you don't even have to be watching, you can just hear him thinking. And you can't wait to hear what's about to come out of his mouth. And so you just leave it and you're tense and you're excited to see what's about to happen. And when you can get to that, that's something special. Mm. People really want to know what you're thinking.
I think it's quite a maturing thing for a lot of comedians. I've seen a few just in the time I've been, you know, seeing so many, and them suddenly taking on this prophetic style from their previous joke style, and they're like now delivering in this, you know, I'm going to wait, I'm going to make you wait, and you're going to want to know what I hear, and I have something to say. It's quite interesting, because I'm hearing a lot, even from the writing world, you know, so many people are saying, oh, comedy's dead, because people are becoming too sensitive about every subject, you can't say anything anymore. Nonsense. Yeah, it just will adapt. And I think the next level of that is this prophetic style where people are expanding on these subjects and still being able to find the humour in them. But they're just talking about their point of view in a way that is, it's listenable. You want to know what they have to say, because it's intelligent. That's what comedy is, right? It's a form, higher form of intelligence delivered well.
Comedy is funny.
And funny, yeah.
Just funny.
Yeah.
Else. But then you can do whatever.
But
you
I think that they're the people that I'm interested to watch at the moment, who are sort of like, Ed Gamble was here a week or so ago.
That's great.
I said John Robbins a couple of nights ago.
Great.
And these people just sort of unpackage a subject matter, almost like they're thinking it through on stage. So there's not it's not as, I mean, nothing's better, you know, than, you know, one too funny, a punchline, you know, a feed and a punchline. But I think in this era of political correctness, of people unpackaging an idea, going, why is that offensive? Why are we offended? Is it stupid to be offended by it? Or are we doing? And just really examining a subject matter is actually kind of a very interesting direction that stand-up seems to be going in, which I'm certainly enjoying.
Genuine curiosity is met with open arms. And a lot of the things that people are saying, well, you can't talk about anything anymore, is coming from a mean-spirited place. And so it's true that it's not easy to be mean anymore. People don't necessarily want you to be as mean as they did, but you can still talk about anything. You just can't be lazy about it. You have to put the work in now. But you can talk about anything. I have no truck with this. It's harder to talk about things. Maybe it's harder. You just have to be better. You can't be lazy, and that's all. So
anything lazy,
and that's good.
I find that blaming others for something that's changed is usually just laziness, because you're not growing yourself. You're just trying to do the same thing over and over again. The definition of insanity. Comedy adapts. It always has. It's changed so much for so long. It will adapt. Nature will find a way.
And so it should. I mean,
thank you, Jeff Goldblum.
His Netflix special will be out next month.
You know, I saw him host a comedy show once.
Wow!
And he was so funny.
Really?
Yeah, Jeff Goldblum hosted this. I was in Montreal, and I went to one of the gala tapings like for TV, and they give him the host isn't necessarily a comedian; it'll be a celebrity a lot of the time. And so they have Jeff Goldblum coming out, and he's just Jeff Goldbluming. And I can see his prompter; he's going way off script. People in the box must have been losing it. But I remember at one point he's just like, "Your next act, very hot right now, very hot act, so much heat." Not quite the heat of a supernova sun, but hot. Ladies and gentlemen, Godfrey.
What? What are you doing?
He's a man that has fully accepted his style of speech as peculiar.
I watched him take an acting class in LA once.
Wow.
So it was quite enjoyable. I only had a gallery seat to watch. I wasn't in the workshop itself. I was just watching him sort of workshopping these actors. It was an incredible thing about just, again, what we've been talking about, being in the moment and reacting to what's happening rather than sort of planning a result, which obviously goes against the slightly toss of writing a joke, because you are planning a result of that joke, certainly. But
just trying to find the balance between the two.
Exactly, yeah. So do you find that you get anything from your versus the audience shows that you put into your traditional stand-up? Does it start subject matters?
Yeah, it'll get me thinking about things, and sometimes I'll get a new premise. I record them all, and I'm actually going to start releasing them as a podcast. This is fun. I get some. I haven't gotten as much as I thought I would yet, but I can feel it coming. I think this Edinburgh is going to be really good, because I'm still learning how to do the show. And so once I get better at that, then I think it'll be good.
Where is it going to be in Edinburgh?
I'm doing it on Bob's Bus.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it's perfect. It's just a bunch of people arguing on the top deck of a bus. It just couldn't be better. At 5:20 every day except for the 14th. So it's nice. I'm not competing with most of the comedy shows. So you can come out, do this, and then go and see all the big famous people and start crushing it. And don't just see famous people if you're going to the Fringe. See people you've never heard of. There's a bunch of great ones. Go see Pierre Navelli. David Whitney.
Well, I won't be there. So.
No? Well, fuck David Whitney.
Well, that's the point.
Evelyn Mock. Go see her. She's great.
That's the point of the Fringe, isn't it? That people seem to forget is these big comedians, they'll be on tour, and there's plenty of chance to see those.
I don't know. I mean, somebody said to me, well, they need the big names to pull in the audience. No, you don't. No. The type of person that and I'm sure John Bishop is a delightful man, but he, 1 year, and this was a long time ago, so maybe, you know, he thought it wasn't on, but 1 year he was doing like two shows a day in the Usher Hall, which is like a 3,000-seater venue.
Yeah. And you're like, well, that's 6,000 people a day that don't go and buy a ticket for actual fringe shows.
Yeah.
John Bishop can fill that hall any month of the year. It doesn't have to be in August.
Mm. Yeah.
And I don't think it's like Glastonbury that they come for the headliner and then they see other things.
No.
People come for the fringe in general. They didn't come because the headline act was this year. There is no headline act. But I just think if you're going to the festival, you should go and take as many chances as possible.
Yeah,
experimental. That's the point of the word fringe.
The whole idea. I saw a show just called It's Art. Just a bunch of A's.
Amazing. Put some in the front of the program.
It was no, because it started with it's.
Fuck that up.
And it was just so funny. It was just this guy giving a terrible art class. Really, really well. He committed to the whole character and it was really involved. It's so silly and so wonderfully pointless that I love it. It was one of my favorite things. And he still does it every now and then. I'm killing myself that I can't remember his name right now. He does a lot of work with Colin Holt as well.
Oh, yeah.
So he was involved in Colin's last show. I can't believe I can't remember his name right now. Andrew something. But that's... I never would have seen that. Oh, wow. But because it was under the Fringe and it just kind of... I was like, I'm nearby. I don't want to go see it. And it's one of the best things I've ever seen at the Fringe.
It's interesting how there's so many like little gems there as well. Like, there's a lot of theatre at the Fringe.
Yeah. I like the way you said that like it was a surprise.
I am.
It started as a theatre festival, mate.
Well, yeah, but, you know, everyone knows it for comedy now. Yeah, you're the add-ons that took over.
Yeah,
you're the infestation. But then you get loads of weird little, you know, theatre shows there.
That's great theatre, and everything's only an hour, so, you know, if it's shit, it's going to be over soon.
No, true investment.
You know, you can go in and see some great one-act plays, little two-handers that are really... the ones that I don't get is when you see, like, Amdram companies or student companies doing sort of, like, some masterpiece destroyed to fit it into an hour, like... Why would I want to see the Amdram Society of Ipswich destroy Macbeth in an hour?
Yeah.
I mean,
unless they called it that.
Exactly. That's what I would see. Let's destroy Macbeth in an hour. That'd be great.
Yeah, I have a friend, a really old friend of mine. Her name's Lucy, and she's been going up to the Fringe forever, before I'd even heard of it. And she exclusively goes to see theater.
Really?
She sees theater and, like, me. and maybe, I think they go see Pappies because they're hilarious. For the most part, it's just theater and they go and see a ton of plays. And they always purposely see something that they think they won't like, just to see. They go and see something that they're pretty sure will be bad, like Ipswich ruining Macbeth. And then they take a bunch of punts. And it's so cool to talk to her when she's up there. She's like, I saw two amazing plays today. I saw three that I almost slept through. And I saw one that I think I've hated more than anything I've ever hated in my life. It's like, what a great day. You felt so much. You saw so many things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I want to try to see more plays. I've never seen one in the Fringe. Because I don't share. But I'd like to. I'd like to. Do you go and see any?
Yeah, I went up there many times before I... even entertain the idea of doing stand-up.
Oh, okay.
So I trained as an actor before.
Yeah.
What
made you cross the bridge?
it's a convoluted story. I was in LA and an agent...
What agent, David?
An agent.
The look on your face. No, tell us the agent.
No. Why are you in LA, David? How did you get hold of this agent?
at the time, I was represented in London by somebody who was far more famous representing stand-up comedians than standing up than representing actors.
Okay.
So when this mutual friend of mine got me a meeting with an agent...
What mutual friend, David? What we're trying to get to.
He assumed I was a stand-up comedian because I was represented by Paul Dedridge in the UK, who at the time had Michael McIntyre and Rob Brydon and people like that.
Well,
and he legged it to LA, ironically, with everybody's money.
Good old Paul.
this guy this swanky Hollywood agency seemed to think I was a stand-up comedian, and it seemed to really impress him. So I saw no good reason to disillusion him of this. It hurt his feelings so much.
Oh, absolutely.
And then one
truth will do that.
That's therapy hour with Chris Betts. Can you be his Jiminy Cricket? Every time.
I think we're too deep now. So, you lied to this man.
And then one morning he phoned me up and said, I've got you a spot. And I had to either do the spot or tell him I'd been lying.
Great.
And 10 years later, I'm here sat with you.
So the spot went well.
Yeah, first spot went amazingly well.
Crazy, that's great.
But I was a posh English dude in Beverly Hills.
Yeah, so you were playing on very easy mode.
Yes.
Yeah.
A posh English person talking about how crazy LA is to LA people.
Okay, yeah. It'd be impossible to fuck that up.
My opening joke was, I love it here in LA. Walking down the street, I can, you know, take in the sights, and by the sights, I mean the women. In London, if I look at a woman's breasts, I will get hit by her husband or boyfriend. But in LA, the husband or boyfriend has spent so much money on those breasts. He's like, yeah, drink them in.
Yeah.
I spent 15 grand on these puppies.
And you don't have that in your set today?
No.
You're not still open with it. No.
What, in Bethnal Green?
Walks off, smoking gun.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the first gig went really well. And then I came back to London thinking that stand-up's a piece of piss. Then I had 2 years of playing rooms above pubs to three people, sometimes with a microphone, sometimes not. I realised that it wasn't as easy as that first.
So why'd you stick with it?
I just fell in love with it, man. Nice. Acting, which I still love and I still do, but if you have an idea for a bit, you can just go and do it immediately. You can literally go, you know, fuck it, I'll go and find an open mic night tonight and go and kick this idea around. It's not as much as it used to be, but it is a meritocracy. You either make them laugh or you don't.
I think it's still a meritocracy. Yeah. We're human, so nothing's perfect.
Yeah.
But there's nobody that's doing well.
But the commercialization of it has made a TV... People are good at being a TV product and not necessarily good comedians. They're good at being a TV product, but now they're getting booked back on the circuit, even though they never could get booked on the circuit before they became a TV product.
I feel like you're talking about someone very specific right now. I really want you to name them. Can you name them and then we'll just beep it out?
Yeah. If you list all of them, I can run it really quickly.
The credits at the end.
Roll credits. Here we go.
And then this list will be at the end of the year episode.
Yeah. PDF and.
No, it's still a meritocracy in the fact that you come, you know, people that Dave Ward books here on the Thursday nights at the Bangalore. Some of them are people who already do the Fridays and Saturdays and using it as their new material night. Mm. And some of them are people that haven't got in the Fridays and Saturday nights.
Yeah.
And, you know, if they slam it on a Thursday, then they get a 10 on a Friday, and they do one on the 10 on the Friday, and they get a 20.
Yeah.
And that still exists.
Yeah.
But there are people that get picked straight out of new material, out of the new act. Like tonight, we've got the So You Think You're Funny heats.
Jesus, that's going to be rough.
And... you know, there will be some people in the So You Think You're Funny at the end of Edinburgh this year who will get picked straight to put in TV product into TV vehicles because they are seen as a good product for one reason or another.
It's so cruel. It's so cruel to do that to people.
Yeah, I think you said cool.
No, it's fucked up, man. You ruin someone.
Yeah, it's true because they haven't learned their trade yet.
Yeah, they don't know, like, if you get pulled out of that, out of a new act material night, and then they're like, hey, we got everything for you. All these things that you're supposed to take 10 years to get. You ready? And they go, I guess. I don't know. You seem to think I'm ready and you do this for a living.
Mm.
And it's so cruel because you'll just break people.
Yeah. When they come out the other side of it, when TV isn't calling anymore, they won't be ready for what's left.
It takes a real humility to do stand-up in a sense. It takes an insane ego as well. But you have to be able to eat shit and be fine with it.
Yeah.
You have to be able to come back from having a crowd hate you so much that you ruin their week. Like, they tell stories about how much they hated you at work a couple days later. You have to be okay with that. That's a part of this. And that's not a humility that you learn when you go straight to the top. And then it's a real heavy fall. And so you break a lot of people that could have been really promising. A lot of people that if they'd stayed in the clubs and just worked at it, could have been fucking great. And I honestly, I don't have anyone in mind right now, but like, that's a dangerous precedent to set, is straight to TV and then back to clubs. I feel that way when I see Broadway shows with like reality TV stars in it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you doing? Oh no, this is gonna be so sad. Do you know all the mean things the newspapers are gonna say about you and your family's gonna read?
Because even if you're just okay, you're going to be criticized.
You're in a West End show, it costs £50 to get into that goddamn show.
Yeah, and that's for a bad seat.
Yeah. They're gonna eviscerate you. People are gonna hate you. They're gonna be mad at you for ruining their time.
I bet the other people in the cast as well aren't good to you.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Because they've all worked.
At the moment, the particular paper dragon in the West End, of course, is Orlando Bloom coming to do Killer Joe, a part made famous by Matthew McConaughey, is going to be publicly aborted every night for 8 shows a week in the West End by the stringy diarrhea that is Orlando Bloom.
How on earth do you go from Matthew McConaughey to Orlando Bloom? I mean, we only just started taking Matthew McConaughey seriously in the last 5 years anyway. But
the McConaughey.
He is very much.
But he was amazing to be in with. He just went on this bizarre trip of guy. I mean, I remember seeing him in Time to Kill and just thinking, who the fuck is this guy? He's amazing. He was incredible in his first sort of chapter of his career, and then he just did all these ridiculous rom-coms where a dog died.
It's tough though, because he's a very good looking man, so you get agents and they go, well, you should do this, and they're like, and there's money, so
there's a lot of money.
Can you blame the guy?
Yeah. I think the telling thing is, if you decide whether or not to watch a Matthew McConaughey movie, is he leaning on the poster? If he's leaning on something, then don't watch that movie.
If he's standing up straight and pointing, then you're like, whoa, baby.
Yeah. He's got his arms crossed and he's leaning against something. Normally, a woman.
That's a good idea. A woman's leaning away from him, but still looking.
Yes, that's the one.
When I open up Netflix next, I'll just take a protractor out and just see the level of how bad this movie might be or how good. Yes. It's all right. It's all right. Says it's 75 degrees. We're just about to get away with it.
Dallas Buyers Club. He's sitting, so it's fine. It's not quite awake. He's on the car.
Dallas Buyers Club is not only brilliant, but when you realise how little they did it for and how quickly they did it.
Oh, did they? I don't know the story behind that.
Oh, yeah, it's completely independent.
Like, really? Jesus, good for them.
No, nothing done in more than 3 shots, 3 takes. It's a real sort of genuine independent movie.
Good work.
And that was kind of, you know, so when we all realised, oh, yeah, we remember that. I remember you in Amistad.
But he did the classic, didn't he, to remind everyone, it's like, yes, I am good looking, but in this film, I will make myself look like shit, just so you all know that the good looking isn't important.
Yeah.
I can act through that.
That was his Man in the Iron Mask.
That was a bizarre movie that had Gerard Depardieu playing a Frenchman with a French accent, Jeremy Irons playing a Frenchman with an English accent, and Leonardo DiCaprio playing a Frenchman with an American accent.
Love that.
And they were the Band of Brothers. Who are your parents? I know they're not actual brothers, but they're meant to be a brotherhood from the same part of France.
I love that. I love it when they go, you know what, the audience has grown up enough to not care about this.
The Kevin Costner Robin Hood movie, another great example of no one cares.
But the moment he, because he does make an effort to do an English accent in it, but the moment that he really goes American is when he hits the
the beach of England after being freed from the Middle East, when the Crusades, and he hits the beach and goes, "I'm home." he's chosen that moment to just throw the English accent.
That was actually a plate shot from Waterworld. They just went, just get it in. It's pretty much the same.
The versus the audience, where are you doing it? I've seen you've been doing it up in Camden, you're doing it on the road. Where can people find details for this show?
My website's the easiest way, thechrisbetz.com. Nice and simple. All my dates are on there. You can book tickets pretty much to any of the shows via my website just with like two clicks, so it's really easy. I tweet about it and Instagram and everything, but it's at 2 Northdown, which is the old invisible dot. Near King's Cross.
Yes.
Which is great. They've been
How
really fun.
Cool is that venue?
Love it.
You're in with the cool people, aren't you?
I know. They're very nice. That's all I know. They're super nice people.
Nice change in King's Cross.
Does Invisible Dot still exist as a production company?
I don't know what he did. He tried to start something else. I'm not sure. I think he's still doing the Chapel show.
Right.
But I'm not sure what else he's doing. It's like a different group of people. It's the same room as the Invisible Dot, but it's a new group of people running it.
And now what's it called?
2 Northdown, because that's the address, 2 Northdown Road. So I'm doing that once a month. Normally on, I think we've been averaging the first Tuesday of the month, but it's kind of jumping around. But in the first week, midweek, and it's like £3 cost.
And the website is again?
TheChrisBetz.com.
And your Twitter?
Mr. Chris Betz.
Easy peasy.
Yeah, lovely.
Thanks for coming on, Chris.
Thanks for having me. This was great.
I'm glad you enjoyed
it. Thank you.
Cheers, man.